Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to generous Americans who voluntarily subscribe to this program, including Paul L. Susser. That's L. Susser. Sorry, Paul. Del Leonard, Robert Forns, and Annawell Rinaldi. You can help, and if you're able, just log on to my website at peterbcollins.com. Click on the tab You Can Help. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. In the second portion of this podcast, Dar Jamail returns. He was our unembedded reporter, the go-to guy on the war and occupation in Iraq. But he lives along the Gulf of Mexico now, and he has been an unembedded journalist, and he has the BP cough to prove it. He's got some stories on the problems with the cleanup and some other issues, too, coming up later in this podcast. Our first guest today is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. He's a Renaissance man. It's his music we're hearing right now, Shahid Butter. And this tune is called An Old Friend. I'll put a link up to his personal website as well as the Bill of Rights Defense Committee website in the information file about this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Shahid Butter, thank you for joining us today. You got your law degree at Stanford. We're a teaching assistant to a well-known professor, Lawrence Lessig, an expert on constitutional law. And you're also a musician and a poet. It appears you've survived at least one trip to Burning Man.
A few, in fact, yeah.
All right. And first of all, I thank you for fighting for a return to constitutional rule in this country. I'm one of those people.
Thank you for paying attention and caring about it yourself.
Well, it's deeply important to me, and I thought I had lowered my expectations appropriately. I never thought Barack Obama was a dangerous lefty or a firebrand of any sort, but I believe that as a former professor of constitutional law himself, that he would do everything he could to return us to constitutional rule. And I am chagrined that on virtually every front, things have not improved, and in too many cases, things have gotten worse. Wiretapping continues unabated. This phone call is intercepted by the NSA. We don't know what they do with it. We don't know if Benny's over there actually listening to you and me talking today, Shahid. But the calls are intercepted. The emails are intercepted. They papered it over with the FISA so-called reforms of 2008, and Obama broke a promise and voted for that. They told us they'd fix it if the Democrats won majorities in the White House in 2008, and in fact, they have made that worse. And on this program, we've covered the issues of torture, the failure to hold accountable those who authorized torture and devised the policies that broke our laws and violated our treaties. And so with that as a long-winded interruption, I want to thank you for your work, because there's nothing to me that's more important. None of the legislation that the Democrats claim victory over since they took the White House in January of 2009 are as important to me as returning our constitutional rights.
Yeah, and you know, I fully agree with you, Peter, and I shared at one point in time, your hope certainly in the president, and the idea in particular that he is a constitutional scholar, and he does have a funny sounding name, and is himself from a multi ethnic background, and you know would get it, so to speak. I think I have the same sort of hope, and in the president's defense, I don't think all of this is within his control. On the other hand, I do think there is a great deal more that both he and certainly the Congress could do. A lot of my disappointment really in here is in Congress, because every time Congress has had an opportunity to revisit the oath to defend the Constitution, it seems that every vote out of either chamber, it's almost like there's a race to the bottom, like who can assault it more. And you know, you saw this in the Patriot Act, you certainly saw this in FISA, you saw this in the Military Commissions Act and the detention context, context under the Bush administration, and you saw it again under the Patriot reauthorization this spring.
And you know, here I don't fear that Democrats take a position and lose to the Neanderthal Republicans. I would rather see leadership
right.
and the Democrats stake out a very strong pro-constitutional position, even if in a particular fight, say, over renewal of the Patriot Act, they don't prevail. Because you know, we need to establish that that is an important political position and a viable one.
Absolutely, and I think it speaks to the distinction between principle and pragmatics in national politics. And among the reasons I think that Americans did rally so broadly to elect the president is because as a candidate, he spoke to principle, and he spoke to principles that were unifying, shared across the political spectrum, right? And it's interesting when you look at freedom and privacy, for instance, vis-a-vis warrantless surveillance or due process versus arbitrary detention, those aren't left or right issues. Those are American versus Soviet issues. And it is absolutely the case that the Neanderthals, as you put it, or you know George Bush, were quite committed to the Soviet position. And I had thought that not only would a constitutional law professor, you know, from a diverse background, be attuned to the things that have always made this country great, but also that you know, as a political matter, setting aside the principle, it's a very strategic position to take when you have the opportunity to peel off supporters of your opponent's base. And there are a lot of people on the right, a lot of libertarians, a lot of small government Republicans who are not fascists and not supportive of fascism, who would be very willing to follow a president or a leader who's willing to speak out to defend the Constitution. And I think that's part of what happened in the 2008 elections. And I fear that having essentially abdicated his campaign promise to restore constitutional rights, the president has left himself and certainly his party in the Congress vulnerable politically by failing to stand on the principles that he claimed.
Now, your organization and a large number of others have co-signed a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I want to get to the letter in a moment, but first, I want to talk about the renewal of the Patriot Act that occurred in February of this year.
Mm-hmm.
While we were distracted by the last-minute machinations over the health care bills, the Senate very quietly just attached the renewal to another bill, and there was very little debate, there was very little coverage of it, and those of us who oppose the draconian measures of the Patriot Act had very little moment, very little opportunity to be heard and to try to shape at least some reform of this expansive set of laws. It's not a single law. And we were not given that opportunity, and it was a calculation on the part of the Democratic leadership that they didn't want to distract us from the health care reform issues by a much more significant and long-term constitutional matter.
That's right. You know, and to digress a little bit, just to contrast those issues, you know, the president entered the White House speaking of an aim to conciliate and bring the nation together. In choosing health care as the first legislative priority to push, I don't want to say that that was a bad priority, but it was not one that brought people together, certainly. A program that would have focused on, for instance, rolling back surveillance and restoring constitutional rights, I think that may have been the issue to bring people together, right? I mean, I think part of the problem also is that he led with Guantanamo Bay and leading with the promise to close the facility and then being sold out by Congress within the first month of his administration. Even the people in his own party, I think the White House grew very skittish about constitutional issues generally.
Well, I think Rahm Emanuel trumped Greg Craig.
That's exactly right. Yep.
And maybe even
Greg Craig is now back in private practice.
Yeah.
Don Johnson is no longer, you know, poised to head OLC. All of the constitutionalists have been pushed out of the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people left are the moderate Clintonian pragmatists.
The Eric Holder model.
Yeah, Though I think the Attorney General, Eric Holder, I do think is in a somewhat different place than certainly Rahm Emanuel, in that in the instance of torture, for instance, while the accountability regime remains far back from what I'd like to see, and it is certainly the case that all of the decision makers remain not just at large but also in prestigious positions, the Attorney General has demonstrated at least some independence from the president in choosing to move forward with an investigation at all. And the White House is so timid that they didn't even want to have the junior-level CIA agents who were threatening detainees with drills and mock executions. They didn't even want to prosecute them.
Yeah, so but I understand your point, Shahid, and I'm not trying to demonize Eric Holder, but for me, the defining issue on detainees is Scott Horton's reporting on the three Guantanamo inmates who were spirited out of the main compound one night in June of 2006 and came back dead.
Yep.
And
suicides, they called them.
Yes. Yep. And these are homicides. We don't have enough information to characterize them as murders. But clearly, that rises to the level of the low bar that was set by Eric Holder as the basis for investigation or prosecution. And his underlings at the Justice Department have said those cases are closed.
Yep. And nor should there. And ultimately, for me, I don't think the bar should be low. Right. We fought a world war over establishing that if you commit torture or authorize it, you go to jail, period. And, you know, we have violated that principle. I think the veterans of the conflict in World War II who gave their lives to establish international human rights are rolling in their graves because we have betrayed that principle wantonly. And the fact, for instance, you know, that Judge Bybee, who's a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, or John Yoo, who's teaching at the University of California at Berkeley, the idea that they're each pulling $250,000 in taxpayer money for their salaries after having offended not just the Constitution and not just federal statutory law and not just international commitments, but our legacy in World War II, that is offensive. And I think it's offensive not just to those of us who care about civil rights, but anyone who's in the criminal justice system, which continues to prosecute the rest of us relentlessly for far less serious conduct. But, you know, if you're politically connected and you violate our planet's most fundamental commitments, then it's, you know, not a big deal.
Well, I've never been arrested or indicted, but I would love to try to tell the judge, I'm sorry, I'm looking forward. I'm not looking backward to that bank robbery or that drunk driving incident. And, Your Honor, that's the law of the land.
I'd like to see, yes, you should make that case before Judge Bybee in particular.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about, first of all, the abuses of the expanded rights that were granted to law enforcement under the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
Because the FBI Inspector General has not once, but at least twice, reported on widespread abuse of what are called national security letters. And these are essentially self-executed warrants that an FBI agent can use, doesn't require a court order, and they go to my library or they go to my bank and they say, we want to see information on Peter B., what books he's been reading and who he's been writing checks to, who he's been getting money from. And as you give us this information, you can't tell Peter.
Yep.
No matter what your privacy policy says, no matter what your agreements are with him, we trump that and we have the right to get this information but maintain secrecy about our acquisition of it. And again, the inspectors general have reported widespread abuse by the FBI. And then the final Bush Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, just unilaterally implemented new rules which amount to no-knock warrants or you know, warrantless inspection or investigation or interrogation based on an FBI's agent's representation that they have not even probable cause, but just some reasonable issue that they want to explore with somebody. And so this creates a police state in our own country.
I think it certainly can, and I fear that we're well on our way to it. The Patriot Act saga is particularly objectionable in that, you know, a lot of people will say, if there's a dangerous authority on the books and we're scared of how the government might use it, we want to see proof and demonstration that it's been abused before we curtail that authority. Well, the IG, as you noted, has given us that proof on, in fact, three different occasions, 2006, 2008, and again this spring, a mere month before the president signed the Patriot Act into law again, The IG released another report documenting not only abuses of national security letters for the third time, and when I say abuses of, I do mean tens of thousands of cases of abuses of, but also the, an abuse of a whole new authority that the FBI invented beyond what the Patriot Act offered, called exigent letters, that were authorized by a secret memo from the Obama White House. And that, to me, is problematic when this administration is actually giving cover to the intelligence agencies to stray even beyond the radically permissive authorities granted to them by Congress, a very compliant Congress, I should say.
And when was this secret directive issued by the White House?
You know, I'd have to check, to be frank. It is the IG's report was in February, and it cites it, but okay. I do not know the date. The memo was actually secret when it was issued, but it was cited by the IG.
Okay. Uh-huh. And so... What recourse do we have as citizens? We can carry a copy of the Constitution with us, like so many of our members of Congress like to do, but it seems that they can blow holes in it at will, and that we are left gasping, trying to assert our basic constitutional rights.
You know, there was a time when we could rely on courts to defend rights, and you know, the rise of a lot of models of activism that turn on lawsuits and going to court to gain remedy, I think, was predicated on that historical period. The problem is that we have lost the courts, right? The courts have essentially become complicit, and they've lost their independence, you might say, and the courts, Congress, and the executive branch are all aligned now in the aim to give more power to the executive branch of the U.S. federal government and less power to the individuals, the sovereign individuals in whose name the Constitution is drafted. And when you have the courts, even the Supreme Court dominated by executive power deferentialists and Congress intimidated from asserting itself to check the president, it really does fall to we the people to do it. And I think there are actually lots of opportunities. Not only can we do all the normal things that I think a lot of us have been trying, like talking to your member of Congress and encouraging them to abide their constitutional responsibility and stand up, but also going to state legislatures and city councils even to raise rights above the federal floor. City council members are a lot more accessible than members of Congress. You have to fight for time with a congressperson, but a city councilor, a lot of times, they don't even have staff, and they really appreciate the contact and support from their constituents. And because city councils are only 10 or 12 people instead of 430 in one chamber and 100 in another, it's a lot easier to get stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
So they both are more accessible and more influential over the bodies that they compose. And so if we're really concerned about a lot of these issues at the federal level, we at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee very strongly encourage people, and we're eager to support people who want to address their local representatives to do Congress will not.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, and it does give us a route and a voice. And to your previous point, Shahid, I have taken advantage of my access to elected officials, and I have to tell you how shocked they are when I will simply blurt out to them, and I'll give you an example. Mike Thompson is the Democratic congressman. He's a blue dog from District 1, which runs from Napa County all the way up to the Oregon border.
Okay.
And I end up seeing him about once a year when he comes back to the district for the 4th of July break. And 2 years in a row now, when I've encountered him, it's not like a meet and greet, just happen to see him on the street, I'll say, "Hi, Mike, how you doing?" And we'll chat a little bit, and then I'll say as politely as I can, "I want my Fourth Amendment rights back."
Right.
Now, he serves on the Intelligence Committee. He knows more than I do the depth of the violation of my constitutional rights. And you can't imagine the shock on his face when I bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
I appear to be the only American, the only constituent, I'm not quite in his district, but a neighboring one, but the only Californian who comes up to him and says this.
And it's interesting when you see like Marcy Winograd running in L.A. against Jane Harmon, raising many of these same issues, or Daniel Ellsberg in the movie that was just made about him that almost won an Oscar, raising many of these same issues, or Naomi Wolf in her book, The End of America.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that I think a lot of us are talking about it, I don't think these issues have really risen to the level, the forefront of the average American's mind. And I think folks, whether it's because people are more focused on the economy or Britney Spears or
Lindsay Lohan went to jail.
Yeah, right.
My God,
exactly.
Is there a constitutional issue there? I don't think so.
It's funny you should say that. I do know someone who has actually submitted a FOIA request to the jail to uncover whether or not she was strip searched to support litigation challenging the strip search regime of other inmates. So, you know, there's at least a dimension there that, however creative we have to be in finding it.
Well, I'm sure Lindsay is desperate to make a contribution beyond bad TV shows. So I'll give her room to improve there or make some sort of contribution. Now,
one idea on the Fourth Amendment issue that you raised a moment ago when you were talking to Representative Thompson, it does strike me, and I think you're very prescient to seize upon it, you know, there are a lot of discrete abuses. You know, you were talking about some of them before, the warrantless wiretapping scheme, for instance, or the authorities under the Patriot Act, or the FBI's infiltration powers that we raised awareness to in this letter. If you put them all together, or for that matter, profiling, like in Arizona, right? If you put it all together, what all of these different abuses have in common are violations of the Fourth Amendment. It's the right against unreasonable searches and seizures, and it's being violated, shredded, in fact, from two opposite directions. On the one hand, you have all the dragnet schemes, the warrantless wiretapping scheme, the FBI, the Patriot Act. On the other hand, you have all of the selective enforcement regimes, whether that's Customs and Border Protection, interrogating Muslims about their political beliefs or their religious views. I wrote a report on that about 2 years ago, or whether that's ICE in the southern border or Arizona State Police or local police questioning people about their immigration status for having a broken taillight. That's similarly non-individualized suspicion. It's suspicion by race or religion or national origin or viewpoint expressing a particular point of view, but it's not individualized.
It's also permitted bully tactics to be used, and I'm really glad you raised this, Shahid, because I just recently did an interview that'll be released to my listeners in a couple of weeks. But Carlos Miller is a journalist and photographer in Miami, and check out his blog at carlosmiller.com. He has been arrested twice by police officials in the Miami area for simply taking photographs. First of a street scene on Biscayne Boulevard, where there were five cops working a beat, and they pulled some guy over. And Carlos was simply taking pictures of their work on a public street. There was no reason for them to deny him access. And they claimed that he nonviolently resisted arrest, which is a new one on me. But ultimately, he met a judge who was in cahoots with the cops. He was convicted on one of the charges. It was overturned on appeal. He did the appeal himself. I encourage people to go to his website and see what's going on, because since he went public, a bunch of people from all across the country have contacted him who have similarly been squeezed by police officers in different situations, where they were told they could not take pictures or videotapes, and often 9/11 was cited as the reason. Not the Patriot Act or not any particular statute, but just, oh, since 9/11, you know, we don't want people taking pictures of public buildings. Carlos Miller has been banned from taking photographs on the light rail system in Miami. Okay. And so this kind of repressive, heavy-handed behavior by cops that is reinforced often by the courts, and defense attorneys are reluctant to take on cases like this because it's going to make it more difficult for them to do business with the same judge, the same prosecutors in the future.
Or, you know, in some cases, like the one you're describing, I don't know enough about that particular case, but similar cases to it, where police have cited the suspicious activity reporting system. This is the SARS initiative run by the Director of National Intelligence.
I thought SARS was a bird disease.
There's that, too. Well, there's another kind of disease that has unfortunately been rolled out by the federal government, and its essential contours are to conscript the nearly 1 million state and local law enforcement agents around the country into feeding information about supposedly suspicious activities like taking pictures and video or drawing or taking notes into databases that will then feed the data mining operations. Mm-hmm. And it's part of this whole notion that if we just collect enough information about enough lawful behavior, somehow some analyst somewhere using all the modern computing tools are going to be able to predict the next threat before it emerges. I find that operational theory very dubious, and I think its threat to the Fourth Amendment is apparent. because it says that you don't have to have any suspicion at all of a criminal act having been committed, whereas the Fourth Amendment has long required probable cause to arrest, reasonable suspicion to pat someone down and check them for weapons. What SARS and other data collection initiatives say is no suspicion required at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what CBP is doing at the border. Customs and Border Protection will copy anyone's electronics without suspicion. And they've won the right in the Ninth Circuit to do it. And it's preposterous. And I do think that the citation of national security to justify the complete disregard of core constitutional principles. The Fourth Amendment was not an ancillary provision, right? This was at the center of the individual liberty interest that the Constitution was written to protect. And the idea that it has been just so thoroughly disregarded by your right, the executive, Congress, the courts, local analogs to each of those three branches, and increasingly by police, it is a real problem. But I think also, if there's any point I could leave your listeners with, it's that there's also an opportunity there, because if we frame our concerns in terms of the Fourth Amendment rather than just the FBI, or rather than just the Patriot Act, or rather than just the NSA and the wiretapping scheme, or rather than the DNI and the SARS initiative, or for that matter SB 1070 and profiling against Latinos, if we frame our concerns in terms of the Fourth Amendment, we have the opportunity to defend the rights of all Americans at once.
And Shahid, on that note, I challenge the Tea Party members who listen to this program, and I know there are a handful because I've seen the email addresses of some of my listeners and people who post comments at my website, and I challenge you to stand up for the Constitution. If you want small government, you want to keep your guns, all those sorts of things, you and I can respectfully disagree, but I would like to see a real unification of left and right politically around these constitutional issues. And let me address something you mentioned a moment ago about the airport security and the way they can copy your electronic information.
Mm-hmm.
I know a guy, not well, but he was traveling overseas. He came back into the airport at San Francisco, and they grabbed his laptop. And there was no cause for that I know of any real suspicion, but they found a child pornography image on his hard drive. And, he was intercepted by an agency that was supposed to secure airlines and make sure that terrorists didn't penetrate. And instead, they picked him up on a completely unrelated issue and used the surveillance that they say is supposed to keep us safe.
Right.
To violate his privacy and bring him up on one of the most draconian laws we have.
And it's interesting when you look at, even in cases where they don't find anything criminal, they're still retaining the data. And one of the most nefarious parts about this is that the opportunity, the Supreme Court, has long ruled that the Fourth Amendment applies very differently at the border than it does within the country. And what CBP, Customs and Border Protection, under this administration has interpreted that to mean is that you can basically do whatever you want with people, and if it's an opportunity to seize information about their financial transactions and their medical history and their email correspondence and their notes and their chats or whatever, that you should just do it. And they're actually copying laptops wholesale just to retain the data and to map social networks and whatever. I mean, it is very, very deeply dark, and I don't necessarily think that this particular president has it in for civil society or has fascist aspirations or anything like that. But the point is that historically, one reason as a country we have very consistently resisted these kinds of authorities is because of the possibility of abuse. And the mere possibility has been enough in the past to keep these sorts of programs from emerging. Now we've seen not only the possibility of abuse, but as we were talking about a little while before with the Inspector General in the Justice Department, we have documented the abuse, and yet still the authorities expand and expand and expand, and privacy and liberty shrink and shrink and shrink.
And Shahid, just one other example, coming back to Carlos Miller in Miami, who has been banned from taking pictures of the transit system there. If that same measure had been in effect on New Year's Eve in Oakland this past year, the case of Oscar Grant would never have come forward.
Right.
And this was a young man who was on a BART train. He got in a fight with some people, and the BART cops pulled him off, And one of them was tried, and the jury believed his claim that he was reaching for his taser when he accidentally drew his pistol and shot this young man, Oscar Grant, to death. And if it
weren't, he was lying face down on a train platform.
Indeed. And if it weren't for the passengers with cell phone cameras, this would have been completely whitewashed and buttoned up, and we never would have even seen an investigation and trial of this police officer.
Yeah. No, it was appalling. And I think that, you know, the issue of police brutality, as well as the profiling, which is also very apparent, I think, in the Oscar Grant case, it's another way of linking all these things back to the Fourth Amendment, right? Whatever your race, whatever your concern discreetly in terms of the particular policy or program that you're concerned about, we all share an interest in the Fourth Amendment, and that's true across the political spectrum, libertarians, conservatives. You know, the Fourth Amendment and privacy, those aren't progressive interests. Those are conservative interests, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a progressive, but I'm defending conservative interests in defending the Constitution, and I think, you know, we're all in the same place here. And the fact that everybody has a right to the privacy that the Fourth Amendment defends, everybody has an interest in restoring constitutional rights, I think makes it, A, very, very opportune for local candidates and candidates for public office to defend those principles, because they can curry support from literally anyone who's paying attention. And I think, B, it also makes it very opportune for us as organizers and activists, because we can find support among unlikely allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a very ripe moment to see those sorts of novel coalitions that you were speaking of before, hoping to see emerge. I you know, seeing the Tea Party and this, for instance, this whole dialogue around whether or not it's racist, I think there's a really interesting question to see whether or not, faced with the opportunity to defend constitutional rights like the Fourth Amendment in the context of warrantless wiretapping or FBI infiltration and surveillance, where the Tea Party comes out on that. And I think the people who really are concerned about small government, really are concerned about individual rights, I hope very much to see them on the same page as the rest of us who've long been arguing for a restoration of checks and balances on the executive branch.
And Shahid, I referenced this letter that you and other organizations have sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'll put up a link in the show file so people can read it for themselves. And let me tell you that one of the things that caused me to invite you on the program today was the history that you offer. I'm a little older than you are, and I was doing a talk show in Chicago back when Nixon was president and when Nixon resigned. And I knew about COINTELPRO, and it was blown open in the trial of the survivors of Fred Hampton against the U.S. attorney and the United States government. And we did a segment on the Fred Hampton case last year on the dubious anniversary, I think it was the 40th anniversary, of the state killing of Fred Hampton. And there's a powerful book about that one of the attorneys who represented him wrote last year. But I think it's really important for this context to be presented, because since I have seen our rights trimmed and then expanded and now trimmed again, I see this in the longer view.
Yeah.
And most people are driven by television and our political leaders to look only at the fear generated since 9/11.
That's exactly right. And you know, these aren't new questions. We've been through this before, and we decided the last time this came up, this issue of pervasive government spying and whether or not people have Fourth Amendment rights to be free from political interference, which is what COINTELPRO was. You know, we already decided as a society that we didn't want this to happen, and yet it's happening again under our noses. And what the it is the politicization of the federal law enforcement apparatus. In the 1960s and 70s, 14,000 pages of congressional testimony documented a pervasive program by the FBI to violate the rights of peaceful activists, to infiltrate the civil rights movement and destroy it. It was, in the words of the Church and Pike Committee, a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed at neutralizing political dissent. And unfortunately, while we think of those things as in historical terms, the problems are back. And that's why we wrote the letter to the Judiciary Committee. Ultimately, there were 50 organizations, almost 46 altogether, that signed on. And among the things I thought that was relevant in the letter was the fact that so many different communities shared that interest. You know, on the letter there were Muslim, Arab, South Asian groups, there were Latino groups, there were environmental groups, peace groups, civil liberties groups, you name it. There was representation essentially from every community in the country saying the FBI has been violating our rights for a decade. We need you, Congress, to do something about this. And it's long overdue.
Let me mention just a few of the signing organizations. My good friend Father Roy at the School of the Americas Watch, Progressive Democrats of America, the Government Accountability Project, Equal Justice Alliance, Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power and Space, Council on American Islamic Relations, Center for Constitutional Rights, and your organization, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, among many others. And I think that this is a very important issue to raise. I appreciate the manner in which you have raised it, because we do need people to understand that these kinds of power grabs, the accumulation of power by the executive branch, have occurred over the history of our country. And we successfully pushed back in the 70s and 80s on the domestic abuses by the FBI and the federal government, and also on the international atrocities committed by the CIA. And I want to reference one other book that my listeners know about and recommend it to you, Shahid. It's called A Terrible Mistake. And it reveals the chemical and biological weapons programs that the U.S. undertook, including the use of LSD as a weapon, which occurred in the early 1950s and on into the 1960s. And what I see there when you look at the long term is that we never really stopped violating the Geneva Conventions. We never really stopped torturing or at least advocating torture, because when we stopped doing it for a while, we exported it to South America and Latin America through the School of the Americas.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, we don't have the squeaky clean history that many Americans are taught in school and just kind of accept without any skepticism.
That's right. One thing on a similar but somewhat different note, if you look at the Fourth Amendment, like we were talking about before, mm-hmm. and this idea of restoring it, it's interesting sometimes when speaking to communities of color who I think will very aptly note that, you know, America has, quite frankly, never respected the Fourth Amendment. I mean, maybe during the very brief period of Reconstruction following the Civil War, but, you know, African Americans, or before that, Native Americans, you know, they've never been afforded constitutional rights, and you know, that remains the case today, despite the presence of a black president. You know, you could look no further than the instance last fall, you know, when Henry Louis Gates, the professor at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and the beer summit that ensued. I mean, what that whole incident said to me was that if you're a rich Harvard professor who knows the president, you can hope to get some redress when the cops, you know, arrest you for no reason. But what does that say for everybody else? And I think the fact that profiling is so problematic to so many communities at so many different places, you know, driving, walking down the street, entering the country in the airport, it almost doesn't matter where you are. Mm-hmm. If you have dark skin or look like you're from somewhere else, in this day and age, whether you're Latino, Muslim, Arab, South Asian, black, Native, you basically don't have rights. And that's a real problem for a country that claims to lead the free world.
Yeah. No, the Gates story is amazing. He was caught breaking into his own home and was guilty of having an attitude when the cops asked him what he was doing in his own home. That one is quite a story. I want to refer to the letter here and quote a little bit. We urge Congress to hold hearings to better understand the standards under which FBI agents initiate investigations of First Amendment-protected activity in the context of speech and political activism, as well as religious activity and practice. So what do you think will come of this, Shahid? Is there enough concern on Capitol Hill that the Senate Judiciary Committee will actually address these issues?
I fear not, which is one reason why we wrote the letter. There are certainly members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who have long been stalwart allies and defenders of the Constitution, among them Senators Dick Durbin, mm-hmm. Russell Feingold. Each of their offices have actually been quite focused on this. In fact, in the letter, we quote from a letter that Senator Durbin actually wrote before the implementation of the FBI guidelines that we're criticizing now. That was in December 2008. And at the time, Congress objected because the FBI didn't engage them at all. This was in the very waning days of the Bush administration, basically the enactment of a new policy that gave the FBI the authority to infiltrate activist organizations, infiltrate religious institutions, actually mandated a program to identify, locate, and allocate law enforcement resources to the, all the minority enclaves in different cities around the country, basically profiling per se, you know, just actually mandating profiling at that level, while disclaiming that it's profiling, you know, by virtue of semantics. You know, the contention on the Hill is that it's not profiling unless there's a cop, you know, stopping you. If they're just monitoring you, or if they're just surveilling you, you know, it's supposedly that's not profiling.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this issue where after the FBI changed its policies, or pardon me, after the Attorney General, then Michael Mukasey changed the FBI guidelines in 2008, the first of the policies that implemented it was entirely secret. It was never released to the public. I sued the FBI 2 years ago to get the document. When it was released, the entire section on what the FBI calls undisclosed participation, what the rest of us know as undercover infiltration, that entire section is blacked out. Nobody, even in Congress, has any idea on what ground or on what basis or when the FBI chooses to infiltrate a group. And there's no indication of what the actual accountability mechanisms are, what the oversight mechanisms are. What we do know is that FBI agents and informants have been turning up all over the place in random places that wouldn't make any sense, in very many cases, initiating proposals for plots and bribing people to participate and then prosecuting them. And, you know, that's been a real problem for the peace movement, which has really been affected by this and the infiltration and the mistrust that it has sown. It's been a huge issue for the environmental community. You know, environmental causes have moved to the center of the mainstream political attention at the same time that the proposals to address those issues have slid to the right because the radical wing of the environmental movement has basically been criminalized.
Well, and we have case after case. The group in Miami, the Lackawanna, the Lodi Mosque case. In each case, we have a paid FBI informant with a record, somebody who has his own criminal record, and who is motivated to deliver for the agency, not only for the paycheck, but often to win relief from sentences due to their own criminality.
Right.
And in each case we have seen, and the Miami case is the most egregious, where the FBI provocateur, very much like COINTELPRO, very much like what J. Edgar Hoover instructed people to do to decimate the Black Panthers and other organizations in the 60s, these people were orchestrating law-breaking, saying, hey, why don't we take an oath to Osama bin Laden? And why don't we get some uniforms and go blow up the Sears Tower? Well, these were ideas that were coming from the government agent. And that kind of police state activity is something that needs to be more widely exposed, because the corporate media coverage of these cases makes them out to be guilty before a trial is ever held and basically defers to the government that this was a terrorist investigation and they just barely saved us from another death plot.
Right, and you look at the people who they're charging in some of these incidents, you know, I can think in the Newburgh, I think there's four defendants in Newburgh, New York,
mm-hmm.
and one of them's a schizophrenic, one of them's a heroin addict, you know, the other two come from a really, really poor part of town and were offered $50,000 to participate.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that's not what counterterrorism or law enforcement look like. And when you said that, you know, we need to know more about what the FBI is doing here, that implication of executive secrecy is another issue, much like the Fourth Amendment, on which all Americans share an interest. You know, we live in a democracy, and in the Cold War, our country struggled successfully against the Soviet Union. Among the things that was supposedly very different about us is that we lived in a democratic, transparent government. And this speaks to, this is where the rubber hits the road, right? Do we live in the Soviet Union or do we live in the United States? Are we, is the FBI a law enforcement agency or is it the KGB? And you know, a secret institution operating on secret policies with secret laws, infiltrating secretly institutions around the country, and initiating plots to ensnare unsuspecting people in their plots, that's more like the KGB than anything that would have existed in the America that I grew up in.
Yeah. Well, Shahid, it's a real pleasure to meet you by phone and talk with you about these issues. I fully support what you're doing, and I'd love to have you reach out to me in the future when you take on actions like this. I'd love to spread the word and support them in any way that I can.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your obvious attention to these issues and being engaged on it and sharing the analysis with your listeners, and I'll absolutely do that.
Shahid Butter, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, on the web, bordc.org. Thank you, Shahid.
Thank you.
In talking with Shahid, he mentioned the Soviet Union and our declining free speech rights in this country. And I dug into the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives. Harry Shearer, the very talented Hollywood guy who is one of the voices on The Simpsons, among many other things, he put together this piece back in the 80s called If You Want Free Speech, Go to Russia.
This is the sheriff of Yahoo County talking. If you're selling smutty rap, you better start walking. No use suing. No use swapping. The judge says I can come in and hush you. If you want free speech, go to Russia.
Bonjour, this is Veronique Raskin. I am the CEO of the Organic Wine Company, and I want to personally invite you to join the Peter B. Monthly Organic Wine Club. Call me for the details, and I do answer my phone, at 1-888-ECO-WINE, or visit us at www.theorganicwinecompany.com. A bientôt, j'espère. Merci.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. And we're heading south to the Gulf of Mexico to check in with Dar Jamail. Now, Dar is our go-to guy on the war and occupation in Iraq. He, of course, published Beyond the Green Zone, dispatches from an unembedded journalist in occupied Iraq. His more recent book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now he's an unembedded journalist in the BP zone. How's your BP cough, Dar?
Well, fortunately, I only had it for a couple of days. So I'm fortunate, unlike folks that have to keep living down there.
Yeah. Now, I know you moved to Texas, but I don't know exactly where. Do you live near the Gulf?
No, I'm in far west Texas. I'm quite far away from it.
I see. Okay, so you've made a couple of reporting excursions to the affected area over the last month. I've been reading your dispatches at truthout.org.
Just got back from spending a month down there.
Mm-hmm. And give me a scene setter. How does it feel? How anxious are people in facing the unknown impact of the damage related to this spill?
It's a pretty grim mood down there. I spent most of my time in Louisiana, but did go to Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida as well. And pretty much in Louisiana particularly, and then Mississippi second, because those are basically the first two most affected states, it's a pretty grim mood because people understand how big this is and how long-term the impact is. And you know, and plus, particularly with the fisher people along the coast of Louisiana, they understand that their livelihood is decimated for a long time, if not indefinitely. So it's a very grim mood, and it is kind of I've heard it described as kind of a slow motion Katrina. And one person put it this way: she said, "Look, how do we start to recover when we're still having to respond to this kind of ongoing disaster on a daily basis?"
Mm-hmm. And BP published its quarterly report. They've set aside $32 billion as their expense. They've committed to at least $20 billion in payments to people affected by the spill. And on the Public Television NewsHour last night, Ken Feinberg, who has been put in charge and claims full independence from both BP and the government in settling claims, he was meeting with very skeptical members of the public who are clearly in deep financial pain and don't know who to trust.
Well, he's meeting with very skeptical members of the public, and they're skeptical because they have a right to be. He, you know, him claiming independence of the government and BP is hogwash. He was appointed by the Obama administration to this post, and then he's being paid to be in this post by BP. And when asked about a week ago how much he was being paid to do this job by BP, he said, "That's between me and BP. I'm not going to talk about it."
Mm-hmm. And do you think that he'll be able to set up a transparent process and be able to get money into people's hands who deserve it?
Not at all. In fact, this guy's been acting more like a bad used car salesman on TV than someone who is compassionate and really concerned about compensating people rightly. And for starters, $20 billion is nothing. You know, this is the initial amount, of course, that BP theoretically set aside, and they at least initially said there's going to be more, but since that time there hasn't been any more talk about more money being added to this or when that might happen. And, you know, he's been going around trying to pressure people, give really under time pressure, saying, "Look, take this deal, work with me, I'm going to get you compensation, I'm going to save you going to court and having to pay lawyers over extended years. This is going to be less painful, and you're going to get a lot better deal with me than you're going to get by going the other route." He's basically acting as a salesperson, going out trying to convince as many affected people as possible to settle now to avoid the possibility of BP facing much larger claims further down the road, both for law of livelihood and longer-term health effects on people, of which there's going to be massive amounts of both.
Well, and anybody in the Gulf who has even a limited awareness of the outcome of the claims of victims of the Exxon Valdez spill knows to be skeptical, because after years of litigation, when it finally got to the Supreme Court, they cut it down to 10%. Of what the lower courts had ordered and what people had expected to be receiving. And so it's got to be so difficult to confront the choices available, either to go with Feinberg and expect to be screwed now, or go to the courts and hope not to be screwed later.
That's right, Peter. I you know, that's very precise, and I can't add anything to it other than to say this is also another reason why there's a very grim mood with affected folks in Louisiana, because they understand the predicament they're in, and they also understand simultaneous to that that this is such an incredible health disaster to them, that you're down there on the coast and you can smell it, you can taste the oil, it your headaches, it burns your eyes, it gives you rashes. It's that intense down there, this oil and dispersant mix. And they understand that at least for now they should leave, if not in the long term permanently leave, because their livelihoods are being decimated. And yet where do they go? What are they going to do? They have no way to make an income now unless they decide to work, hire their boat out to BP and go skim oil, which of course makes their health worse. And then, you know, they're basically facing a situation where they're going to have to decide, do I want to be a willing refugee? Because that's the situation with a lot of these folks right now.
Well, and unlike in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, I'm not aware of any cities that are, you know, calling out to people along the Gulf Coast saying, come on up here for 6 months or a year. We'll find a house for you. We'll find a job for you. Part of it is that we're all hurting so much locally that it's hard to, you know, sincerely make an offer like that. Because, for example, you know, in California, it's hard to imagine that we would bring in thousands of people from the Gulf states and that their lives would actually be better than staying at home.
Well, that's exactly right. And then the other part of that equation is that these people, they don't want to leave, even though they understand, a lot of them already understand they may well have to leave for various reasons. But, you know, I've been down there on the coast with these people, and I see, you know, here they are, they're third-generation fishermen, many of them. They bring their boat up the canal. They tie it off right in front of their house. Their parents and grandparents live in the same community oftentimes. All their friends are there, their entire community of people that they live and work with. And they've been doing this for generations. And then how are they going to leave from that situation and go start over somewhere else when all they've done is fish their entire life? It's really a kind of daunting thing for them to try to get their heads around, although many of them understand that's what they're going to probably have to do.
And Dar, on TV, particularly on the commercial channels, they try to give us some good news stories. And they say, well, these people who can't shrimp anymore are being hired to boom. I guess the plural of boom is boom, from what I've been able to figure
out. That's correct.
But you are reporting that there is a lack of organization, that people aren't getting paid on time, that they're not being offered any protections from the illnesses caused by exposure to, as you said, the toxic soup of the oil and the dispersants. And so this appears to be a really ugly situation, and the corporate media in this country is kind of putting a happy face on it all.
They're trying to, and this is increasing by the day right now, which is rather distressing, because I've talked to several of these people personally who are working either on boats going out laying boom and skimming oil, or people involved in the beach cleanup, and both of them are reporting deleterious health effects, sometimes very, very serious health effects, on up to the person I spoke with who works for a company over nearby Pensacola called Gulf Asphalt Contractors, or rather the Gulf Asphalt Company, GAC, said they're weeks behind, late getting their paychecks. Oftentimes their full hours don't appear on those late paychecks. Then when they've had to contest those hours, they get paid at a lower rate than what they were supposed to get paid. Like I said before, health effects, problems, people going to the emergency room, then being told to go straight back to work because there's no problem, this is completely safe, not being given days off. The woman I spoke with hadn't had a day off in 45 days, and the only reason that she had just gotten a day off was last weekend because of Tropical Storm Bonnie. Forced them to take a couple of days off. So really people being treated like slave labor, and then those going out on the boats, like I said before, talking about the severe health impact that they're dealing with, coupled with that the booming operations, and I've seen this both from a boat and from a plane firsthand, the booms don't work. This was common knowledge from the beginning, and most people within the oil industry admit this up front. They're basically for PR to make it look as though something's being done to stop the oil. But a boom basically works on 2D, on paper, on a blueprint that, if you put a boom out in water, any wave action whatsoever is going to force the oil over it.
Yeah.
So that's not going to take much at all, given you're on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. And then, of course, given the fact that BP's used three quarters of a million gallons of dispersant subsea down at the wellhead on the oil, most of the oil's never even reached the surface. So needless to say, it's going under the boom. So it's a whole joke, this whole booming operation. Anytime the wind kicks up at all, they get blown all over the place. We have a lot of pictures of this on the website. It's a total joke. So needless to say, these people are discouraged and angry. And then the other thing, just to kind of underscore all these points, this whole economy now that these people, especially the fishermen, the out-of-work fishermen that are using their boats to do the skimming and the booming, this is a false economy. So at some point, BP is going to say, all right, we've done what we can, we've responded, now we're going to close this whole thing down and move on. All these people now have no income, plus the fishing industry and the marshes are oiled and decimated, so now what are they going to do?
Well, they're captive. They have to take whatever BP and the government are willing to give them because they have no real other options.
Well, that's true, except the problem is now that this will eventually shut down, I'm afraid probably sooner rather than later. We're right now under a media blitz by P of, you know, they've gotten rid of Tony Hayward, they're giving themselves a PR facelift and trying to put a happy face on this thing and that, oh, this spill is not as bad as we feared. And they're going to be probably moving on in a matter of months. And then once they go away and all those beach cleanup jobs and all the Vessels of Opportunity programs shut down, then these people are left high and dry. They have no way to make an income, and then plus what they used to do before, particularly the fishermen, that's going to be gone, at least for a substantial period of time. Then they're going to need to try to figure out what to do, and that's why it becomes even more really, you know, kind of the falsity of this whole $20 billion compensation fund, as though that's going to be enough to fully compensate someone for their entire loss of livelihood, for them and their family for the rest of their lives, and then multiply that by the tens of thousands of people that that's going to apply to along the Gulf Coast. And you can quickly see this $20 billion compensation fund is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, it's to keep the small people pacified. And Dar, in some ways, this is similar to what happened after 9/11, when Christine Todd Whitman, the head of the EPA, said, there are no environmental problems at Ground Zero, and the rescue workers and the demolition crews can come in there, and you don't have anything to worry about. And now there are tens of thousands of people with very serious chronic respiratory and other conditions that are clearly directly linked to their work at the World Trade Center site. And likewise, with this Corexit dispersant that they have permitted BP to use, that has never been properly tested. The side effects are you're reporting them anecdotally, but to my knowledge, there's no scientific analysis of the impact of these chemicals, either short-term on humans or long-term on sea life.
That's right, and I'm glad you draw the parallel to 9/11, because we also have another a tie, and that's that Kenneth Feinberg, in charge of this $20 billion so-called compensation fund, he was in charge of running the compensation situation for the families and the victims of 9/11 as well. And, of course, there was similar outrage then as we're seeing now already. With the dispersant itself, there actually have been tests, some of them performed by the EPA itself. For example, they did one test using it in an area on shrimp, and it killed 50% of the shrimp upon immediate contact, and then most of the rest of the affected shrimp died shortly thereafter. Longer-term health effects do include leukemia. It's a neurodepressant. It's mutagenic. Longer-term severe cardiovascular problems. I mean, this is both of the Corexits being used by BP right now are both industrial solvents, and when mixed with the oil, they create a substance. Remembering, of course, that crude oil is already considered a hazardous material, and when you mix it with a Corexit, that toxic soup is four times more toxic than either of those, either the Corexit or the crude oil on its own.
And the dispersant works in unpredictable ways depending on where it's applied. But in one of your reports, you describe how when motorboats go out into the water and out into the open water, that they are kicking up these suspended solids or suspended thicker liquids that are subsurface, but still very toxic and subject to churning when propellers and, the other machinery interact with them.
That's right. In addition to dispersants have been being used inland. I've talked with many people in the Vessels of Opportunity program and fishermen who are not in it but live on the coast have all said the same thing, and that's that they are hitting these dispersants inland, which is something, of course, they said they wouldn't do. The Coast Guard was supposed to keep them from doing it, but then have granted them more than 44 exceptions to be able to do that thus far and counting. So when a bay fills with oil, for example, and then they hit it from the air with dispersants and it sinks all that oil to the floor of the bay, it will stay there in the night, and then as the water warms back up with the temperatures of the day, this stuff comes floating, I heard it described as a lava lamp, back up to the surface, and then, of course, there it is, kind of a consistency of thick, kind of wet peanut butter is how it was described. Of course, it's off-gassing, and it's tremendously toxic, and it smells, and it gets all over everything, and that's another way that this is coming up, and so that's really one of the main reasons why, aside from just the big sheets of crude oil that have washed on to the shores of the coast of Southeast Louisiana and the Barrier Islands, Mississippi, and Alabama, that this dispersant, when they hit it, it comes back up, and then of course sinks again at night during when the temperatures cool back off, and it hardens back up and sinks, and then all of the chemicals off-gassing from that, of course, are swirling around in the air of the coast. And when you drive down there, you can smell it, you can taste it. It burns your eyes. It's palpable. I mean, there's no mistaking that I'm going into a very chemically laden area.
And, Dar, one of the things that I have not seen in any other reporting is your description of the behavior of crabs. Describe that for us, please.
Well, it was a very disturbing thing we ran into. One of the days we went down to Barataria, which is about an hour's drive southeast of New Orleans. It's a fishing area, and right in the marsh area where folks live and then take their boats out into the bays and then out into the Gulf to fish and shrimp. And we got down there, and we were just shocked by the chemical effect that I just described. And a fisherman came over named Gene Hickman, a charter fisherman, and he showed us a video that he had taken 2 days earlier of crabs literally crawling out of the water from his canal onto his bulkhead. And that's because everyone down there, himself included, were describing very heavy dispersant clouds swirling around in the canals, coming into the canals from the bays of dispersant-laden oil. And they understood it was creating a toxic soup in their water, so much so that even the marine life, like crabs, were literally trying to escape from the water into the air, and then, of course, staying out would eventually die, and that's exactly what we saw. Then we went down to his house. We saw his sheen-covered canal full of upside-down dead crabs floating right up on the surface.
Wow. Well, that's got to be really stunning and sad to see, you know, up close and in person.
It really is. It was really just a shocking thing to see that really underscored how severe and how intense this situation is for people really all along the Gulf Coast. And people need to really pay attention to the health effects of the oil and dispersant mix, as well as each of them individually, and understand that the vast majority of this oil now is swirling around out in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's only a few scientists now, like Samantha Joy, for example, who are trying to track these giant undersea plumes. Most people agree that's where the oil is, and so the next question, the open-ended question, is where's it all going to go?
Yeah. And, Dar, it appears that there was already a dead zone, an area where there's severe depletion of oxygen in the seawater. And it also seems that both the methane escape, the methane gases that have escaped from the wellhead itself, and the dispersants are going to compound that by further reducing oxygen in the water.
That has already been found by many independent scientists, and so when these plumes swirl around, they do create, as the scientists have reported, there are natural occurring microbes in the Gulf that will eat some of this dispersant-laced oil. But then, of course, in that process of them eating that, the natural degradation of that, then that uses up more oxygen than would normally be depleted had this situation not existed. So thereby, each of these plumes creating its own kind of mobile death zone. And that's another very disturbing factor. Many, many scientists are concerned about it, and it's going to be a hard thing to track because of that, how much marine life is being killed, because when you have dolphins, whale sharks, sperm whales, and smaller fish that then are hit by these areas, most of the time their bodies are going to just simply, they might come up to the surface for a bit, but then if they're not spotted in the week or so they're surfaced, then they're going to, of course, fill back up with water and sink down to the bottom. So no one will really have an accurate count of the deep, deep biological effect of this disaster until we roll around to the next fishing seasons for oysters, shrimp, fish, et cetera, and more bird counts over time can be done. And then we'll see further down the road, I think, the real magnitude of this disaster.
Well, Dar, I really appreciate the work you're doing and trying to really expose the reality of the situation on the ground there. People can read your dispatches at truthout.org and also at your website, dahrdar.org. as we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think really just to urge people to really keep paying attention to this. As I said before, we are in the midst of a big propaganda campaign by BP, and the government's being quite complicit with this and really minimizing the effects of this, both the severity of it and the long-term impact. And I think I really urge people to pay attention to independent media on this and alternative media and unembedded scientists as well as journalists, because a lot of the scientists have been bought off. Yeah. This is a huge disaster, and it's going to have very long-ranging effects, and we all need to really pay attention to it.
And is the press blackout easing at all?
It has eased somewhat, but unfortunately, I think even a bigger factor than the kind of BP-imposed blackout for a while is that, you know, like the media tends to do, is kind of move on to the next hot story. And when we don't have an oil-gushing well now, right now, at least for the moment, at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, it's made it pretty easy for folks to move on. And if that occurs, we're going to really lose sight of the impacts that you and I were just talking about.
Well, and if you can stand a joke, maybe we need to send Lindsay Lohan, Rod Blagojevich, and Shirley Sherrod down to the Gulf so the media will continue to cover the story.
It would help.
Yeah. Dar, thank you very much. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks again, Peter.
Dar Jamail here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this episode. Clean off that oil and send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.